Do you remember the moment you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody? You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you. And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for Friday the 30th of August 2019, broadcasting from www.gospelrevolution.com. Never forget that. One day we're going to be famous. Where we can help you, where we help you reclaim who you really are and help you remember what you did not know that you'd forgotten. We're coming to you from the heart of the gospel, where we say that a text without a context is a pretext for a subtext. But right now, with more consistent, persistent, repetitive CPR of the gospel, is the president and founder of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Williams. How are you, sir?
I am good today, Don, and welcome to the last day of August. My goodness. Yeah, I know.
Now, here's something that's always escaped me. I never see a rabbit jumping around in my vegetable patch saying, it's late, I've got to go, you know, like the rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. Rabbits don't seem to have this, it's all going to be over really soon. Look, time's moving so much faster. What is it that it happens to me? I don't get that.
We may never know the answer to what's wrong with, what's happening, not what's wrong with you, what's happening to you. I'm sorry, I took that a whole different direction, didn't I?
You did. You made yourself a trusted friend to me all over
That's
again.
That's right. And did a funny all at the same time.
You just keep telling yourself that.
Who do you think I was saying it for anyway?
Oh, boy. Well, this week's been a wonderful week. But it's just been a wonderful week because it was, the house didn't burn down for one. And for another thing, the ambulance that was coming to get me when the house burned down did not plow into another car and kill an innocent couple. So it's been a good week. And Laura, she who must be obeyed, is just, my God, you know, I can't believe, Mike, I can't believe how I'm getting the best of the summer wine now. I really am. It's
very
like
good.
It's like this is the best part of my life so far.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm kind of there myself. I guess the magic key is 67 then, right?
Has to be, but you enjoy it because in a couple of days, fella, you will be my junior again and you'll have to abide by every word that I tell you.
But not today.
Yeah, so I guess I've just got to suffer until then. Hey, now, I want everyone to write this date down because I missed it this year until Facebook told me. What is the date of your birthday?
My birth date?
Yeah.
August 16th.
Now, people, I'm asking you, listeners, to wish young Michael a happy birthday on August the 16th next year, because if I forget again, at least that'll get hidden.
No, I was so glad you did. That covers my forgetting yours.
Oh, no, mine is coming up. I won't let you forget it.
And what date is your birthday, Don?
October 13. I was born on the 13th of October in the middle of a storm Friday.
Very good. We will all mark that.
And people ask me, what is wrong with you?
Well, your birthday should explain that, right?
I suppose so. Good. I like the guy that says, you say, what's your birth sign? And he says, oh, my birth sign is Pyrex. I was a test tube baby. Well, all is well down here in northern Alabama where the rain is gently falling and the grass is greening up, though I don't know what for. And everything's really quite pleasant down here. And it's the same way, I gather, where you are.
Yes, we've had the break with summer heat about a week ago now, and what a relief.
Man, I don't need to go to hell. I've been there. I lived in Nashville.
Yeah, this is the heat in South Florida is not this heat. I can tell you that.
Well, that's because you're getting the sea breeze, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, that, and it just doesn't get as hot as many days in South Florida as it does here. That's just a fact. And there were days that when we had our hottest weather, I realized there could have been extenuating circumstances in the weather patterns at the time, but there were times that we were running 95, 96 degrees here, and we edged up even above that, and I would ask for the weather in West Palm Beach, and it would be 85 degrees, and it's like this, the whole world has turned upside down here, so...
When you talked about heat just then, you reminded me, I had this interchange on Facebook this week where somebody said, do you still beat up your wife, is what they meant to say. They said, do you still heat up your wife? And I, you know that I can't resist. And I wrote, please spare us the details of how you used to heat your wife up. And it was, these Africans, I've seemed to have made some friends who are Africans, and man, they speak such bad English, but they do want to speak in English, I suppose, to reach, I don't know why they don't speak in Swahili, but anyway, they speak in English, and some of the ways that they put sentences, you wonder if they put it through a translator that doesn't work. Yeah.
Gospel Revolution.
Well, we have got an interesting day ahead of us. We have done another week of surgery on the Apollos project, and it's been a good week. Family, do you remember last week when we went through Acts chapter 18? We didn't know what we were doing, and we just want to fess up, and that's why we stopped and we said, "Hold up, let's just."
Damn, teeth have fallen out. Let's just. I was playing for the homeless people, a guitar, and just a few years ago in Nashville, and my teeth fell out.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of professional musos with me, and I just said, oh, f*** it, and I pulled my teeth out. And the guy standing next to me said, oh, you didn't.
But we were going through Acts chapter 18, and what we've discovered is that Luke, the historian, ended up mashing so many things together, it was really rather difficult to find a clear line of sight through this chapter and the next one. So what we did was we had a close look at that this week. We also came just that much closer to having this book presentable in all its glory. And we have had Danny Rouse, who has published books in his own right, and we've had Sean Smith, who's published books in his own right. They got together and have put together a Facebook group. Phil Britton, if you still hear us, if you still listen to us, would you please connect with me, beresbart@gmail.com, beresbart@gmail.com. I really want to include you in this simply because you wrote such a cogent and well-presented presentation of the gospel. I don't want to go without you here, but what I'm trying to do is get all those people together who've tried to write a book, and Sean Smith has been very gracious in the way he has made it possible for us to get ISBN numbers. It's coming together, family, and those of you who are at Calgary, physically at Calgary, will get the first fruits. Did I sound good then when I said first fruits? Did I sound really religious? So you'll get them, and then they'll be the book will be on sale as a physical book, and it will also be on sale as a Kindle book eventually. So you've only got a couple of weeks to wait, and it's all coming out. Mike, what should we be doing today? We have been going through Hebrews 13. But we got sidelined off onto this Apollos timeline because it became obvious to, well, I think it became obvious to us that we needed to get a bit more insight.
Well, and I think that it would behoove us to go back since we published our venture into the weeds to back up here and take another run through this in 18. How far we'll get in Hebrews, I don't know. But this, and let me tell you, folks, Don has been working, goodness, into the wee hours of the night and the morning on this for some time.
My knees are red. My fingernails are all cracked. My eyes look bloody. Oh, yeah.
And I have to sit here and look at this, so please pray for me. but I think, Don, this timeline that you put together in Acts 18, there's a lot to be said for it. Now, once this gets written out in a written form, this will make more sense, I think, to everyone. As we add a little bit of descriptive words, what we have right now is strictly what happened in consecutive order. I think there's some of the connective tissue that will be added to this as this goes on. Yeah, I think you will see that as we go into this. But, Don, let's run through this again. We'll do it as quickly as we can. And this relationship is so palpable in the book of Acts that Luke gives us of the relationship between these people, Aquila, Priscilla, Paul, and Apollos. This is vitally important to understand this and see that the qualities and the attributes given to each and every one of these, we have Paul's attributes very clearly written out for us in the majority of the New Testament. And we have Aquila and Priscilla's relationship, the husband and wife, tent makers, and they're joining up with Paul and learning Paul's doctrine. We also understand that at the time there were still followers of John the Baptist who seemed to not know that a crucifixion had taken place.
And that would be some 20 years after Jesus death, resurrection.
And maybe they knew about the resurrection, they just never changed their doctrine, you know. Kind of like Christianity, they know about the resurrection, they've just never changed their doctrine.
Well, some didn't. In fact, in our book, we tell you where to find the followers of John the Baptist, the Church of John the Baptist, which is existing right now in multiple countries in the world, but they're called the Mandaeans. And just you can Google that and see that. So some went back to, some of John the Baptist's disciples stayed with Christ. Peter was an interesting example, and his brother Andrew. Apollos, it took him a few more decades to get his ducks all in a row and his meeting with Priscilla and Aquila. But some people went back to John the Baptist and never left.
This is true. It's very evident here, and that is covered very well here in this chapter. And this man Apollos, goodness, the things that Luke seemed to think everybody need to know about this man, I think one of the most striking things, and you'll see this as we go through it, was that Paul failed to reach the Jews. He didn't stop trying, but he pretty well went through one of his fits. I could say we could safely say Paul had fits occasionally, and he got really upset with the Jews here, and shook his raiment, and which was a very dramatic. He's a drama queen, in many cases here.
I was waiting for him to put ash on his head, and, Very Jewish drama queen.
Oh, my goodness. And he started quoting a lot of really wonderful Jewish phrases like,
may your blood be on your own.
Yeah, your blood on your own head, and my hands are cleansed of your blood. He got really, really into it. We find, though, that Apollos did not get that reaction from the, quote, Hebrews. They seemed to understand what he was saying. Paul had difficulty communicating to the Jews, of which he was one. But you see, there again, knowing that Paul was a Pharisee, this was just the communication style of the Pharisees. They knew it all. They insisted on you respecting what they had to say. And you and yours just needs to listen, and that's all you need to do. just sit and shake your head and nod that you have and acknowledge that you have heard. We learned a lot by knowing what sects that these people belong to, just like James being a part of the Ebionites. Why in the world did James say 5 or 6 times directly, and all of the insinuations we can't even count through the book of James, of his abhorrence with people that had money? We found that out by knowing that, finding out that James was a member of the Ebionites.
And also very closely linked to the, to the Essenes. In fact, some people claim, and I got this from a book, Victor Brennan sent me, and it was everything in it made sense. James could very easily have been the leader of a group that was tucked up in the rocks and discovered in 1948 in the caves of Qumran. It's very interesting to see how much of the old law and how much of the sectarian law. You know, here we've got Pharisees, we've got Sadducees who don't believe in resurrection. We've got James, Peter, John, who are all Jesus plus the law teachers. And then we've got these really interesting parallels between what we found about the Essenes along with James. Now, James hived off and became the patron saint for Ebionites, as Michael just said. But just seeing how the dots are joined, Michael, it's incredible.
Yeah, these and understanding their mindsets as much as we can, which, you know, there's way more information. There were lines that would just seemed like filler for us when we were simply looking for doctrines. We weren't looking for any disagreements or cultures, because Christianity taught us by inference and also by out-and-out teaching that everybody in this area of the world just came to a point on equal footing and had an equal understanding of the work of the cross.
And everybody agreed in the New Testament, lovey-dovey.
Yeah, and that from that they were able to persuade us that all of these writings in the New Testament agreed, because there was just this monolithic understanding from everybody as to who Jesus was, because somebody stood and saw the resurrection and said, wow, you are the Christ. That applied to everybody. Well, it didn't apply to everybody. and so by going in and seeing these, it's like doing the forensics of where everyone was, what they were doing, what they were thinking. As much as is written, we're not trying to go beyond what is written here.
How they interacted.
And how they interacted with each other, and how they acted and reacted to what actually happened in Jerusalem that day. There wasn't this massive, singular understanding that took place. Now, there was a massive, singular event that changed everything, but the understanding of that was not there. And I'll go back to one of my old standards here, that if everything was going so well with the disciples' understanding of the gospel, why in the world did Jesus see the need to take somebody who truly understood the law? Obviously, these guys, Peter, James, and John, were not well schooled in the law. And why did Jesus find it necessary years later to almost forcibly bring Paul into understanding?
Who, in his own words, was a man taken out of time, as it were.
Yes. By admission, Paul says that. Paul felt a bit freakish about being a part of all of this because he knew that this was peculiar. This was offset. But he was the one who had the opportunity to have Christ not tell. I remember, Don, years ago, realizing that, you know, of course, we had always taught the biblical principle that you teach others who are able to teach others who can teach others also.
Uh-huh.
Well, Jesus certainly didn't think that was a good idea when he appeared to Paul and Paul's conversion. He didn't say, now, listen, you've got to absorb the benefit that my disciples have and their understanding, so I'm sending you immediately to Jerusalem. That did not happen. In fact, Jesus said, I'm taking you aside in the desert, and we're starting from scratch here.
Yeah, Jesus said, I want you to learn from the best, not the rest.
Yes, and we would all agree that he did learn the best. So in the process of my understanding and Don's and all of us together of ferreting out the truth of all of this, the thing that has caused us to be able to continue and not dig our heels in on any particular, there's been occasions that I was definitely digging in my heels because I thought I was right. And I will continue to do that, I'm sure, until proven that I am wrong. And I've been proven wrong on many points. But what that does then is that moves us forward even more. But I hope you see to what deliberate extents we go through when there is a change, when there is a shift, we go back through. Not just because we found a verse and it's like, oh my gosh, let's start a new denomination. As has been, more than 40,000 so far because they just found a verse they didn't know about. And then they come up with a whole new sect and a whole new denomination. But instead, we go back and we try to see now, is this move valid? Is it supportable? Does the evidence support it from every direction? And that's what we do in every single case. And we listen to our detractors. We want to hear what they have to say about what we're saying. And sometimes in hearing the detractors, we learn more. It's amazing what somebody who opposes you can say to help you understand what you're trying to think through.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we do, folks. Now, you see this happening and hear this happening as it takes place. And we tell you, you know, we don't prepare for this. But let me tell you that in this case, Don Bartlett has worked endlessly because this is one of those places where we've come so far. We've got to have the backfill. We've got to shore up the walls and the foundation of this, and at any time are prepared to say, wow, we just made a huge blunder. Not past that point ever to admit that we've made a blunder. We greet everyone to challenge these findings, and because it can only further our understanding of the gospel. That's the only motivation here, is understanding the gospel more. It cannot be to raise funds. People get nervous when you change your mind. People want to support something that is always the same. Well,
yep.
Gosh, if you're into learning, come along for this ride. We've learned from all of you out there. I cannot tell you the names. I'm just not going to start mentioning any because I'll leave some out. I've learned from every gospel revolutionary I've ever been in contact with, Don. Threads and pieces that's like, my gosh, and it's just simply a phone call for this or that, and sometimes even in the middle of pledge drive, and I learned so much. So here we have this, and we're going to run down through this timeline, and there'll be things that Don or I, either one, this is where we would like to have all of you in one room as we go, because we know it's going to spark things. You're going to think things that we haven't been able to think. So as we go through this, get your pen and paper out. Jot down some notes of things that caught your attention, because they could be the very essence of what we're trying to communicate, and they could be the very essence of what proves us wrong. Either way is okay, please. Either way is okay.
Freedom at gospelrevolution.com. Freedom at gospelrevolution.com. Send your comments in, and Mike and I will both be reading them. Now, a couple of comments before I start going through this timeline, Mike. A shout-out to Judy Duke, who helped me check the veracity of this timeline. A shout-out to Jackie Barnard, who said, well, you know, I have heard it said that Priscilla could have been the writer, and I wrote back and said, down through the avenues of time, you're not the only one who suggested that, Jackie, and it's a good suggestion. And it's not to be said, mind you, a nagging woman who nags and nags and nags could have had Apollos's ear and said, hey, listen, you need to do this. You need to do this. You need to write this. You need to preach this sermon. You need to do this Hebrew thing. You know, nagging women have got a lot to be thanked for in this world.
And you can write Don on that one.
Yes, Beresbart@gmail.com. Beresbart@gmail.com. So, we start. Yeah, Acts 18, and all of these references until I get to the very end will be Acts chapter 18. I've taken them in verse order. So Paul, in the middle of his second missionary journey, leaves Athens and travels to Corinth, where he makes, in verse 2, the acquaintance of a couple of tent makers called Aquila and Priscilla, who either taught him how to work in tent making or were surprised at the fact that they were all tent makers. We don't know when Paul started to learn the art of tent making. Aquila and Priscilla, in verse 2, had been expats from Pontus near Galatia who had just arrived from Italy as part of the expulsion, the general expulsion of Jews by, not Caligula, by the Roman Emperor Claudius. Now, there were a few expulsions of Christians and Jews, and Christians at that time probably were still thought of as part of Judaism. They were a sect of Judaism called the Way. So it didn't matter if they were Christians or Jews. They were all thought of as Jews by the Roman Empire. So in verse 3, we have Paul moving in with them, where they worked together at tent making. Now, that's what they did to feed themselves and keep a roof over their heads. But every Sabbath, in verse 4, Paul preached in the synagogue, convincing both. So he did the Sunday thing that modern Christians do, and he got down there and he preached because he was a Jew, by every single measure. Because he was a Jew and he'd been trained, you remember, by Gamaliel, he spoke probably, we suppose, to be anything up to 23 dialects and languages. He certainly spoke Aramaic, he certainly spoke Hebrew, he certainly spoke Greek, but in all of these different places, where Aquila and Priscilla had come from was Pontus. They spoke a dialect, but Pontus is right next to Galatia, which is probably where they heard the gospel to begin with, this couple. Anyway, in verse 5, Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia and joined Paul. Now, see, as we put meat on the bones of this, we don't think of Silas and Timothy being there. What were they doing there? Pretty sure that they all dressed up in their Sunday best and and slogged it off down to the synagogue with Paul and sat down there in the front row with Paul. Pretty sure that might have been happening, along with Priscilla and Aquila. But anyway, in verse 5, we also get a strange phrase, that Paul was pressed in the spirit to go the whole hog and teach the Jews that Jesus was actually the Christ, the Messiah. Now, that obviously means that until that time, he was simply pointing out from the scriptures who Christ may have been.
Being very diplomatic with these, with the Jews.
Very. But now he's pressed in the spirit. Now, modern Christianity would say, I got a word from the Lord.
Yeah.
And I don't know what this phrase means. I don't know what being pressed in the spirit meant to Paul. But it meant that he changed his tactics towards those he was preaching to in the synagogue. Well, of course, the very next thing that happens is the Jews bridle at Paul's teachings, resist it, blaspheme it, according to the Greek text. They may have started off this business of rending their garments and covering themselves with ash.
So it was okay for them that he pointed out what the scripture said the Messiah would be, but when he linked that to being Jesus himself, that's when they went off the handle.
That might be the best way of putting it, because I couldn't figure out what he would teach of Christ that he could not teach that Christ was a Messiah, but that makes a lot of sense. He was preaching inferences and observations, but then he preached the clear truth.
Yeah, guess who that is?
Now, as we read through this, remember this. As far as we're concerned, Peter was the apostle that was consigned to teach the gospel to Gentiles. If he wasn't, it seems very much to anyone who's reading through the story of the sheet let down out of heaven, mm-hmm. of the way that Peter went back to the Jerusalem cartel led by James, who God knows how he got into charge, but he went back there and was afraid to tell the truth. So he kind of told them in a roundabout way, which was really untrue. And then they say, well, we're going to talk to the Jews, and you, Paul, are going to teach the Gentiles. It's very interesting. Well, in verse 7, Paul's been castigated by the Jews in the synagogue. So where does he go to live? Right next door to the synagogue.
Now, Don, is there someplace that gives us an indication? Now, he is no longer living with Priscilla and Aquila. Is there anything that tells us how long this period was that he was there in their home?
No, I think he was there 3 months before. It says he was there for 18 months. So it could have been he was there for very close to 2 years.
Okay.
This is simple conjecture. But it's also possible that when he got tagged by the Jews in the synagogue, that is the time that he left Priscilla and Aquila, possibly to keep them out of the mess.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then he goes to live with Justus, who had a house right next to the synagogue. Judy Duke questioned whether it might be aligned with the synagogue, but I think that might have been very difficult to arrange. But he stays in the house of Justus, who, as this verse says, lived right next door to the synagogue. If you you've got to hand it to Paul. Oh, I can't come to the synagogue. Oh, well, how about I come here?
Well, in fact, doesn't the King James Version say that their house joined hard to the synagogue?
Let me have a look. That's a very good question.
I think it's important that we get these images in our head, because from there we can grow in our understanding of what was said, from where it was said. And, you know, goodness, we can make our own movie from this.
Okay, the Greek word is synomerosa, and it means adjacent to.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It says joined hard to. The Greek is synomerosa, and it means adjacent to. So he's now living right next to him.
Now he's on the other side of the wall.
Yeah, now he's living next door to Alice.
They share a wall with the synagogue, yeah.
That is too funny. Now, did he do that by accident? I don't think so. Did God lead him there? I really don't think so. I think it was, I mean, Paul, his whole life that we hear about in the Bible is full of very interesting, clever moves.
Yes.
So I think this was another one of them. Oh, I've got to go outside and stand in the street and look, there's a person going into the synagogue. Let me just engage him. Yeah. So the next thing we know in verse 8 of Acts 18 is that Crispus, who's the leader of the synagogue, you may as well call him the pastor, he believed in Jesus in his household. Now, here's a curious thing. When you look at salvation in the New Testament, there is clearly this evolution of thought. If you look at Peter on the day of Pentecost, believe on Jesus and you'll be saved. If you look at Paul when he was in the prison with Silas and the jailer says, what shall I do to be saved? Paul says, believe and you and your household will be saved. Now, this is where some religions or some sects and baptisms get the concept of household baptisms. If the dad gets baptized, it's as good as a covering for the whole house.
Mormonism gets their doctrine of baptism, yes, out of this by them being baptized for a family. The whole family gets in.
Yes, not even a live family, a dead family.
Yeah, they get baptized. I actually had the opportunity of speaking to the Mormon who lived in California, who was baptized for my last four generations. But to be baptized, she had to have the genealogy exactly accurate. So,
did you thank her?
I thanked her for the genealogy, that's for sure. I got a book on it that she had things figured out that happened in East Tennessee that nobody here knew about.
Wow. And here is yet another doctrine. We find out not only about household baptism and household salvation, but we find out that Paul writes that an unbelieving spouse can be saved by the belief of a believing spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that anymore, do you?
No.
But you know, people who like to quote Paul conveniently just pick him up in bits and pieces. It's very, but see, there was an evolution. What is salvation? Yes. And finally, and Paul eventually comes to his conclusion about what salvation was. Later in his life, he writes to the Romans and says, God figured everyone to be in unbelief so that he could have mercy on all. And you see this evolution of understanding. It's really interesting.
And this book is called The Acts of the Apostles, not even The Doctrines of the Apostles. This is what they said and did correctly or incorrectly. This is their perceptions correctly, correct or incorrect. That one thing helped me with the book of Acts more than anything was to understand that this man simply was determined to write the history, not explain the doctrines or the things that were said. He just wanted you to know they were said, not that they would become doctrines. I don't think that Luke ever had any presumption that he was explaining doctrine. He wouldn't have dropped these little lines with no explanations. This is historically, from his account, what happened, who said what at the time.
And there's another thing to consider there. He wrote what he was told. He did not write what he saw. He wrote what he was told. He did not write what he saw. Ananias and Sapphira, we get many questions about Ananias and Sapphira and so forth. All we know is what Luke was told happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we know. Yeah. In chapter 18 that we're going through now, all we know is what he was told happened. So,
yes. Even Paul being pressed in the spirit, you know, one of Don's points was we can't know what that was because we're getting a story. This is how the story was told. And these are the events. And that's what we're taking from this, the timeline that is established. But please don't go through here and try to pick out things that you may think that Paul was believed or taught later on in his ministry when we get to reading, you know, Galatians and Ephesians and Philippians.
Yes, you cannot build a doctrine out of Acts. No. You really cannot. And if you do, that is very self-serving of you. Mm-hmm. So now Crispus, the leader in verse 8 of the synagogue, believes on Jesus and his household. Now that's a problem for the synagogue. Not only is this troublemaker living next door to the synagogue, but somehow
he's converted the pastor.
Yeah.
Sounds like a gospel revolution going on up in there, right?
Precisely. Too funny. Family, you don't know how many pastors align themselves with the gospel revolution. 1, 2, 3. Oh, well, all of our staff.
Yeah.
And a good many. I mean, we're top heavy with pastors in the gospel revolution. But anyway, many Corinthians heard, believed, and were baptized. Not only did Crispus believe, the leader of the synagogue, but also many other Corinthians heard and believed and were baptized. Doubtless, that happened as they were passing by to go to the synagogue, and Paul said, "Oh, hey, would you like a cookie?" And they said, "What's?"
You're a hoot.
And they say, "What's that question mark you've painted on yourself?" And he says, "Oh, that's the question. Do you know the Messiah has come?" And many. I knew a Christadelphian who wore jewelry of question marks for that reason. Many Corinthians heard, believed, and were baptized. Well, you cannot do that without upsetting or unbalancing the cultural norms. You can't do that. The Lord then says an interesting thing to Paul. So right at this time when the synagogue leader has been converted, many Corinthians have been converted, the Lord says to Paul, "Hey, son, do not be afraid." So there was something that deserved being afraid of. We'll find out in a minute. Then it says that Paul stayed in Corinth 1.5 years in Acts 18:11. And in the next verse, verse 12, Jews take Paul to the judgment seat. Now, these Jews could have been believing Jews, but why would believing Jews take Paul to the judgment seat? The judgment seat was the local district courthouse. And Gallio, the person in charge of that courthouse, says to the Jews, "Rack off, hairy legs. I'm not interested in your doctrinal crap. That's your problem. You sort it out." And Gallio says, "Off with you all. Away with you. You're upsetting my Sunday afternoon." Now, that's in Acts 18:13 through 15. Now, in Acts 18:17, it seems like it's in retaliation that the Greeks beat the ruler of the synagogue. They've got a new ruler. Hello? Gang war. What do you do with this? See, Gallio doesn't listen to the Jews. The Greeks think, "Oh, good, he's on our side." But he wasn't on their side. He was just a half-hearted proconsul. Because if he'd have been a real Roman, fair-headed proconsul, he would have told the Greeks, "If you want to be in jail before the sun goes down, you just keep beating up the ruler of the synagogue."
Mm-hmm.
So we find that that all goes down, and there's a melee obviously in Corinth. Same thing happened at Ephesus. Next time Paul went to Ephesus, same thing happened there. The tin makers in Ephesus said, "Diana is our goddess, and this man is causing us to lose our money, our income, because we are tin smiths and we make little goddesses that people can hang around their neck." Have you heard that anywhere else? "You'll cost us our money."
Mm-hmm.
So in Acts 18:18 is where it says that Paul sails for Syria with Aquila and Priscilla. Now he's leaving Corinth He is now going to Syria, and he's going to end up in Ephesus.
So now this relationship with Priscilla and Aquila now is spanning several years, not just the time that he lived with them, but even when he moved out and moved in with the guy who lived in the house that joined the synagogue. He's spent whatever amount of time he has there, and now he's getting ready to leave. So this relationship, you have to understand, with Priscilla and Aquila absolutely never abated whatsoever.
Ever.
Whether he was living with them or not.
We see at the end of the salutations in Titus and the salutations in Romans that Priscilla and Aquila are still either with Paul. Priscilla and Aquila send their hugs and kisses, or that they are mentioned by Paul. This is a decade later. So, and also Apollos. He mentions these three people a decade later, meaning exactly what you just said, yeah.
Yes.
They never fell out of love.
Yeah.
So in verse 19, the very next verse, Paul goes to Ephesus with Aquila and Priscilla and leaves them there while he continues on. He's going to go on to Jerusalem to a feast, but he leaves them in Ephesus.
He just could not avoid a conflict, could he?
Oh, man.
It's like, oh, look over here, a possible conflict. Let's go.
it's too funny. Now, at that same time, now that's in verse 19, in verse 24 of chapter 18, a fella called Apollos shows up. Here is where he shows up for the first time. Now, he was born in Alexandria, which was as good as the world capital of literature. You've heard of the Library of Alexander that burned down. Well, this was where Apollos was born, and Alexandria had three main districts. It had a Jewish district, it had a Greek district, it had an Egyptian district, because Alexandria is in Egypt. Now, this afforded Apollos a couple of things which we're going to see now. Verse 24 says he was eloquent. Now, that word eloquent is a Greek phrase meaning he was taught well in the rhetoric style and the rhetoric debating style. Now, rhetoric was something that had been invented, I suppose, by the Greeks, and you see it every Sunday morning in churches. Rhetoric is, and in our modern English, all we see is rhetorical questions, but rhetoric is a style of debating. I ask you, is there any sense that we should continue in sin so that sin should get glory? No. We see this in Paul as well. No. If God forbid, how can you sin anymore? Or in church it'd be, God forbid. No, you keep yourself clean and unspotted from the world. You keep yourself clean from the liking this, mate. You keep this.
Preach it, brother.
Yeah. And that's rhetorical. We have taken, now there were a couple of things that rhetorical teaching did. Number one, it created a podium. There was always a podium where it lifted the rhetoricist up above the people he was addressing. And then there was the style of speech. And the style of speech became so polished that maybe only a century later, a fellow called John Chrysostom was called the golden voice by his contemporaries because he spoke with this Greek rhetoric so well that he wowed the people who listened to him. You can look that up. We don't have time to go into it right now. So first thing was he was tutored in the art of Greek presentation, Greek philosophy. This Alexandria is where Plato and all of that Platonic teaching and philosophy comes from. It was Alexandria. In fact, Plato was alive when Apollos was living in Alexandria. You figure that people with minds so great did not meet over a pint of goat's foam down at the local pub? I think they did. That's just me, you know. The second thing in verse 24. Apollos was powerful in teaching the scriptures. So you say, well,
yeah.
What does that mean? What do you think that means, Mike?
Exactly what it says.
I just want you to, your voice, this is your point.
No, I'm enjoying this, Don. You worked on this. And now we're getting introduced to Apollos here in a very dynamic way. Obviously, someone with a strong enough role in the life of Paul that we know where he came from. We know who he was. We know his culture. All of this is being brought forth to us. So this man was mighty in the scriptures. Goodness, what a telling thing. The one thing you know is that this author is not promoting Paul. He strictly is trying to give a historical account of what happened. I know there's a lot of people that have said that in the book of Acts that this is an attempt to promote Paul and to discredit others. But here, I mean, if that was the truth, you wouldn't be saying, wow, there was this other guy who was mighty in the scriptures.
Especially when he was successful where Paul wasn't.
And that's borne out as we go down through here, Don.
Huh. How'd I miss that? Some of you who are listening spent enough time in Pentecostalia as charismaniacs to know what the word dunamis means. Mm-hmm. The word dunamis simply means power. It's the same word from which, as our previous Christian teachers told us, we get the word dynamite.
Yes.
Well, this being powerful in teaching the scriptures is using the word dunamis.
Yeah, not the one that means authority.
Yes.
When they talked of Jesus, they said he was one that spoke with authority. And with Apollos here, it's saying he was dynamite.
He was a dynamite speaker. Hey, yeah. Listen, you better get your legs moving quickly and get yourself down to the Colosseum this afternoon. There's a bloke down there talking, and I've never heard the like. He was a dynamite speaker. He was instructed in the way of the Lord.
Mm.
Verse 25. What does that mean, Mike?
So now, I don't know if, now, is this his first, he's instructed in the ways of the Lord from the scriptures, right?
Because
he's not heard from Priscilla and Aquila yet.
Yes, doubtless he knew about Christ. When Jesus walks on the road to Emmaus with the two disciples, even they say, what are you out of your brain? Haven't you heard the goings on that's been in Jerusalem the last couple of days? And you're asking why we're so.
Was he explaining Christ from the scriptures, still being in the baptism of John at this point?
I think that's all we can conclude.
So he was doing kind of what Paul did then. Paul was explaining Christ from the scriptures without connecting it to the person Jesus Christ. Apollos seems.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, what he was doing before he felt pressed in the Spirit. Yes.
So Apollos here is talking about the way which was prophesied. And he has not yet come to the conclusion that Jesus is the Christ.
I'm reminded of that phrase, prepare ye the way of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Prepare ye the way of the Lord. So Apollos knew that from the scriptures. He knew that.
Yes, of course, with John the Baptist being the follower of John the Baptist, that John the Baptist was the fulfillment of that.
Fascinating. In verse 25, it says that Apollos was fiery in the spirit. He was a firebrand, this boy. Now, Paul also was a firebrand, but here in Apollos, mm-hmm. we see that it's a tempered fervency. It is tempered by something else mm-hmm. that Paul was, I'm not going to say weak in, but he didn't bother tempering his fervency. Mm-hmm. If he thought you were a maggot, he'd tell you, you're a maggot. If he thought that you were not walking uprightly, he'd said, yeah, you're not walking uprightly.
You bunch of jerks.
Yeah. Yeah. And Apollos also spoke and taught diligently the things of the Lord. That means he didn't leave anything out. Diligently means that he was, I'm just going to check this. Oh, my God, the word is, okay. Now, that word diligently in the Greek is a word called akribos, and it means precisely.
Mm. Well, what do we get out of Hebrews? Precision.
All the
precision
way.
From beginning to end. It is precision teaching.
Apollos spoke and taught diligently, precisely, exactly the things of the Lord. So as far as Apollos was educated in who Jesus was, the Christ, the Messiah, the one who'd been promised, as much as he realized that from the teachings of John the Baptist, he taught precisely those things. The next thing we find out is in chapter 18, verse 25, that he only knew the baptism of John.
Mm, so powerful. We are getting an explosive picture of this man, Apollos, of his exact journey, exactly when he knew what he knew and why he knew it.
And how.
Yes. I mean, and why are we being told all of that? Now, he was, at this point, he was still preaching John's baptism. So he did not understand at this point that this man that got crucified in Jerusalem was the fulfillment of all of this. He was still preaching the baptism of John. He was still preaching the scriptures about that one, but he had not seen the full picture of the scriptures applying totally to what had just happened in Jerusalem. This really is quite amazing. So, Don, pick up there for us. I'm on pins and needles here.
Well, there is another thing that this shows us. What do you know about Paul's spiritual genealogy? What do you know? You know nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be a Pharisee, of the Pharisees, and apart from a little bit, is it in Philippians where he describes his standing to be able to preach the gospel of grace? Apart from that, you know nothing. We know that he was trained by Gamaliel, which is like going to Harvard or going to Cambridge today. But we know nothing else. Apollos, we're being told so much more about Apollos here than ever we knew about Paul. So in verse 26, Apollos spoke boldly in the synagogue. Here was a man. Now, I want you to see three streams of consciousness here, three streams of understanding. We have the Jews in the synagogue, fully Jewish. They'd get circumcised and they would do everything Jewish because we're Jews. We just do it that way. That's how we roll. Then you've got Jews who knew only the baptism of John, and they were teaching a slightly different thing. They were not teaching adhere to the law, as the first group were. They were teaching adhere to the law because there is somebody coming. There is a figure coming the Messiah is on his way. See, that's all John the Baptist knew, that Messiah is on his way. Baptized into his baptism, the Messiah is on his way. That's what his followers taught.
And even John the Baptist had to send someone to Christ to say, are you him?
And Jesus says, well, tell him what you see, you know, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the dead are resurrected.
He refused to answer the question.
Very, very, it's so interesting. Now, at this point, in verse 26, Aquila and Priscilla are standing down at the back of the temple listening to all of this wonderful, because they were Jews who had heard the gospel from Galatia in where they lived, Pontius. They're standing back, and Apollos bursts out with something. It's really wonderful from the scriptures and about the Messiah who's coming. And Priscilla looks at Aquila and winks.
Yeah.
She says, hey.
Does he know who he's talking about?
Yeah.
And I think he's got it. He just doesn't know it.
Yeah. Aquila says, I think we got a live one here, honey. And so they connect with him. One of them takes the other out for lunch. And they like what each other has to say. And in verse 26, they expound unto Apollos the way of God more perfectly. He taught in the way of the Lord. He taught in the way of the Lord. They taught him the way of God more perfectly. That word perfectly, I think, is teleos, and it means more completely. They filled in the gaps. They finished his jigsaw puzzle. They put all of the things together that allowed him to see what he'd been previously missing.
Yeah, he got to see the big picture. I'm telling you, that big picture moment is so... everybody out there in the gospel revolution can relate to Apollos when that big picture moment came. And my God, it's there. Look at it. It is undeniable. It's irrefutable. I could never go back. Apollos had one of those moments, as eloquent as he was, as noteworthy and noted speaker that he was.
He heard the bell that could not be unrung.
He did indeed. And these are some of the things that were... I was just thinking, Don, as we were going through this, the fact that Apollos did not put his name to this, after seeing what Paul had gone through by declaring this.
You mean the book of Hebrews?
Yes, the book of Hebrews. The reason he did not sign the book of Hebrews or start out I Apollos, as Paul always did, we've surmised the possibility that Paul was saying, you know, you guys are saying I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos. We surmised the possibility that Apollos was just going to take that off of the table and not sign his letter so that people couldn't say that. I think one of the even more illuminating things we may be getting here is that Apollos saw the trouble that Paul was in and was trying to mitigate his own personal price he would pay for writing this letter, and so therefore may have left his name off because of that.
Makes total sense. And of course, when you're teaching people, you don't want to alienate them up front by saying outrageous things, true
yes.
as they are. And that makes mm-hmm. quite a bit of sense. I don't know how he did it in the synagogues when he was teaching, but in that book of Hebrews, absolutely. There is no wonder, there is no trace. You know, Eusebius, writing 150 years later, said, we will never really know. It could have been Clement. It could have been Barnabas. The most likely contender is Apollos. Mm-hmm. But only God knows. Yeah. Apollos pulled it off pretty well, didn't he?
Yes.
In verse 27, the brethren there, we're talking about Ephesus, write Apollos a glowing recommendation for those he meets further in his journeys to accept him. Now, you're going to be talking about the people who are Jews, the people he is addressing, the people to whom he is bringing now this new message, not only that he was really excellent as an exegesist, but he was also really excellent as a preacher and teacher, as a rhetoricist, and they didn't want him to probably have the doubts that they may have first had when they heard him. So they wrote him glowing reports, which he took with him to Corinth. Apollos, in verse 28, mightily convinced the Jews, and that publicly he did it, showing by the scriptures that Jesus was the Messiah, that he was the Christ. Now, how he did that, I think he did that with some measure of intelligence and some measure of overwhelming debate and some measure of experience from how Paul had been accosted.
Yes.
Now we come to Acts 19:1. It is now AD 54. All of the rest happened in AD 53, when at the end of this, Paul and Apollos and Zenas and Priscilla and Aquila and all, they all get together, and it's AD 66. So it's 12 years later. So we're just going to see, and that's all we ever get told. But in Acts 19:1, and this cost me a day of research, but Paul goes to Ephesus and Apollos goes to Corinth. We are told really carefully, really clearly, really precisely that Paul, in one verse, Paul goes to Ephesus, Apollos goes to Corinth. Now, what happens next is interesting. AD 55, and this, I don't have a verse for you. It has to be a presumption, but it's not one that can be overlooked. Apollos teaches in Corinth. Now, Paul's already been to Corinth. The church in Corinth is already born, but now Apollos goes to Corinth and starts teaching. He doesn't teach exactly how Paul teaches. He doesn't say, hey, listen, you're sleeping with your mother-in-law, get out of there, you maggot. He doesn't say that, or your stepmother, actually. Apollos comes with more polish. He comes with more ability. He comes with more great arguments. And he teaches in Corinth, and this is when the people in Corinth, suddenly, they've had Peter, they've had Paul, and now they say, oh, man, is this guy not the best? We're going to be Apollyons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those Cephans can go, oh, what the heck? He was not a bad fun. He told good jokes at Peter. We like what Paul said too, but this we belong to Apollos. Now, that's where in early Corinthians, Paul in Ephesus, writes to deal with this sectarianism. Paul and Apollos and Zenas are all still friends in 66 AD, just before Paul is executed. We also know that from the teachings in Corinth by Paul, Paul in no way puts down anyone else. I'm of Jesus. I'm of Christus. I am of Cephas. I am of Paul. I'm of Apollos. He never puts down Christ, and he never puts down Peter. Until later, he comes back to revive his comments. He only brings it down now to Apollos and me. He is bound in his spirit. You are not going to drive a wedge between Apollos and me. Apollos learned the gospel from those who learned it from me.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned the gospel from Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty powerful, and that we have this declaration of who learned what from whom. And understand that in the book of Hebrews that is exactly what Apollos says. So we now know that it's one of the things where we know for sure that Paul did not write, one of the many things that we know for sure that Paul did not write this book of Hebrews, that it was this man who was absolutely dynamite teacher of the scriptures.
What Michael's referring to there is Hebrews chapter 2, verse 3. You may want to read it, and that will tell you that the author did not learn this gospel from Jesus Christ.
Mm.
Well worth looking up.
Yes.
Do you think there's any point in going to Hebrews 13, mate? Well, family, we hope that you will interact with us. We hope that those things which we did not cover today that you think we ought to have covered, I hope that you will email us at freedom@gospelrevolution.com. freedom@gospelrevolution.com. Email us there. Let us know what your questions are. Let us know what your you can pick at us if you like. You can pick at us and put us on alert that we're going to get more. That's okay. We don't mind.
Yeah.
We so much more want the truth than we want to be right or wrong. We just want the truth. We done? Oh, yes. Pledge Drive. Pledge Drive.
Don, Pledge Drive starts tomorrow. So as you have listened to this today, we are embarking on Pledge Drive. I must depart Tennessee on the 12th, so I'm going to try to have the majority of the Pledge Drive done by the 11th. I will have a little bit of time, maybe even while I'm there, to do a bit of it. But boy, if I could get the most of this done, and we do need the funds, folks. We told you about the hit that we've taken on for a month for this coming year. All of you who contribute, you do what you can. For those of you who can do a bit more, and you could add something to what you are currently doing on a monthly basis. We're not talking about the pledge drive, which we'll be doing. And during the pledge drive, those of you who can increase your monthly, it would be greatly appreciated and very, very helpful.
And just to remind you, here's the pledge drive song.
Write your check to Gospel Revolution. Check it careful and go rip it up. Make a new one out for two times that much. Now reward yourself for shaping up. This is how you know you made a difference. As the gospel's leaking out all around the world, Gospel Revolution's going higher as millions more see freedom's flag unfurled.
We're going to have a new Pledge Drive song soon, Michael. You're going to love it. But I knew how much you like country music, so.
No.
I was gonna write a Pledge Drive song to the tune of Elvira. Elvira, and I know how much you would have liked it, but I want that to be, like, I want that to be the cherry on the top after you hear the next Pledge Drive song. All right, and so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. If you would like to know anything about the Gospel Revolution, then call our office on
832-318-9339.
And speak to us about how you want to participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the connect link. So now it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett from the GR Studios in the heart of redemption. About that pledge drive. If you want to give and you don't get a phone call from us, may I suggest that you go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the donate link.
Mm-hmm.
There are many ways for you to give. So now it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett, from the GR Studios in the heart of redemptionism.
And it is good night from Michael Williams here in the bonus room above my sister's garage in the secret city. We love you guys. Thank you so much. We have passed August all intact and all is well. And September promises to be a dynamic month for the Gospel Revolution. Let's all have a dynamic month together.
Can I get an amen? Yeah.
We sure hope that you enjoyed today's podcast. And remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week.
It gets better.
There's got to be more. Back and forth, from doing right to doing wrong, 'cause we were taught that's who we are. Well, come on, get in line right behind me, you along with everybody, thinking there's worth in what you do. Then like a hero who takes the stage, when we're on the edge of our seat, saying it's too late, introduce you to amazing grace. No matter the bumps, no matter the bruises, no matter the scars, still the truth is a cross. And
simply can't believe that this unconditional kind of love would be enough to take a filthy wretch like this and wrap him up in righteousness.